We have traveled to about the highest point in the Redwood City area to visit with the creator of two of the most outstanding radio programs, series of all time. He's Carlton E. Morse, and a name like that is one to be reckoned with. Good morning, Mr. Morse.
How do you do? It's good to see him.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Mm-hmm. Would I be right in saying this is about the highest spot in this area?
Yes, but it's in San Mateo County. We're not in Redwood City. We're in the county. It is, it's about 1,500 feet.
It's beautiful
above
view.
Sea level.
Took us a lovely ride coming up and winding around and getting up here.
Going on the way you where you turned off, you'd have gone on down. We're 17 miles from the ocean, and we're about 12 miles from San Francisco Bay. We're right in the middle of the peninsula on the ridge.
How high, or rather, how far are we from Sea Cliff?
Well, that's in San Francisco. That's the area of San Francisco. We're about 40 miles, approximately 40 miles.
So there really is a Sea Cliff area.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, the bus, what do you call them, the buses that pick up visitors and show them the city, always had one man's family's house in Sea Cliff, where they would point and say, that's the Barber house, and, well, did you see, that was just Father Barber going around the corner.
They just took any house there that they thought,
well,
one specific one?
They picked out, finally, one specific one that that they used every time.
You know, we were on that tour, and I think they pointed that out to us, but we didn't see Father Barber.
No.
One Man's Family, of course, was probably the longest-running serial drama on radio. When was the first broadcast?
In 1932, in April of 1932. And it ran about 27 and a half years, ending in 19... I guess that would be 59.
59, yeah.
Yes. That's right.
What were your credentials before you started writing One Man's Family, or to write that? What did you do before that? You were a young man at the time?
Well, I was a young man of, the show started in 32. I was a young man of 31. I had been a newspaper man, both in Sacramento, on the old Union, which Bret Hart and Mark Twain contributed to. And then I came down and was on the copy desk of the San Francisco Chronicle for 3-4 years. And I was on 3 different papers in San Francisco. And then I went to Seattle, on the Seattle Times, I guess it was 2 years. And it was up there when we heard our first radio show. It wasn't a show. It was a boxing championship, and I've forgotten who was fighting. But then we came back to San Francisco, and newspapers were folding awfully fast about that time. So a friend of mine had a job over at NBC, and I went over and was taken on a week-by-week basis to see what I could do. I had written columns for papers, but I had done nothing in a dramatic form at all. September that the crash in 1929?
October, wasn't it? October 29, 1929, wasn't that Black Friday? Or
that's pretty close. But anyway, the week that I started with NBC came the crash.
Mm.
And for the next couple of years, they kept me on as a director and writer for radio. Nobody knew anything about writing for radio in those days. But I was taking on, I was learning. And then I did adventure and mystery stories. And finally, I conceived. I'd always wanted to do a family show. Was a very great admirer of the Forsyte saga.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote three episodes, half-hour episodes, and submitted them to the program department. Well, they thought I was crazy. Everything up to then had been bang, bang, excitement and thrills and yelling and so forth. And I didn't write that kind of thing for the family. I wrote the kind of family that I knew. I was the oldest child of a family of six children. And the program department had said, I'll tell you what you do. You better resign, and if anything comes along, we'll give it to you. So,
don't call us, we'll call you.
That's right. So I took it to Don E. Gilman, who was vice president of the West Coast National Broadcasting Company.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 3 weeks, he called in and said, I never thought of a family show on the air, but I kind of like it. But maybe the audience will accept it, and maybe they won't. So would you write it so that we could bring it to an end after 6 weeks if it didn't go?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we went on the air. I had to cast. See, I had been doing dramatic things for years. I did a show called, it slipped my mind for a moment. I'll come back. Well, the Classic Mist.
Mm-hmm.
We call it the House of Mist. And I did a tongue-in-cheek suggestion that everything that was done in the myths were a little bit on the erotic side, and but not doing anything. In those days, everything was so very carefully edited, so I had to be very careful what I wrote, but the point got over. I got the mm-hmm. point over. And then there was the mystery stories that I did. This went on. I came in 29, and the family didn't start till 32. So I had quite a long time to experience. But I was learning. I was being paid to learn, and that's how the career developed. And with the financial crash in those days, nobody had any money to go to the theater or go out to dinner or anything, and the radio was a godsend.
It was built right into the Depression.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So we just grew in importance. All we had to do was stay on the elevator, and we couldn't go any place but up.
Well, you said you wrote six shows. This was called One Man's Family
at the time. That's right.
And you wrote six shows.
Yeah.
And you cast them.
I wrote
them.
Three shows, and then at Mr. Gilman's suggestion, I made it six with the idea that we'd bring an end to the show if it wasn't satisfactory.
They didn't even give you 13 weeks, only six.
No. And the show was never off from that time till the final ending of the show, 27 and a half years later.
Now, where did you find I'm sure you hadn't developed the full family tree yet at this point. You were doing three or six
shows. I had father and mother, Barbara, and Paul. That was... it was close enough to the end of the World War One that Paul had been a flyer in World War. And then there was Hazel, second child, who was her father. It was a very, very conservative man and very strict. And she was her father's girl and was pretty prim. And as a result, I didn't have many boyfriends. Mm-hmm. And so that was Hazel. Then Clifford and Claudia were twins. Clifford was a kind of a happy-go-lucky, ne'er-do-well. He never did get very far. Claudia was the most independent and rebellious member of the family against the strict family setup. And Jack was just an adolescent boy at that time.
Well, you set the personalities of these people right from the beginning.
What I started out to say was I had worked with these people, everyone except Mother Barbara. I had worked with them over and over and over again, 2 or 3 years, so that I knew them.
You mean
I knew what they did, the actors. Uh-huh. I knew what they did best. I knew how to write for them, and so I selected the characters that I wanted, the actors that I wanted, and built the characters, the radio characters, around those personalities. And so it was hard for me to tell which was Paul Barber and which was Michael Raffetto.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the same way with each of the others.
I must ask you about Father Barber. He has the habit, I guess, of always going that kind of a thing. Now, did you write that into the script, that little thing, and every time he said that it was on the printed page?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'll show you the first episode when we go back upstairs. I have the original copy of it. And you can see that I think that it demonstrates that I had full consciousness of what I was doing as far as the cast was concerned when I first started out to do that.
You were, I'm sure, very positive about this one man's family idea. And that even though they wanted only 6 episodes, I believe that you felt it was going to run longer than that.
Yeah.
And could you see, as you were developing this, even in those early shows, heck, the first 3 shows you wrote, just on speculation almost, could you see going down the path of life years ahead that things would develop?
No. I was writing, as a matter of fact, during the first 10 years of the show, I didn't write ahead. I wrote from week to week, and I was directing the shows. And so I would write a show, we would go in, and there would be some element in the show, or somebody would do an outstanding job, or I would catch something, so that I would take that and build on it for the next episode. In other words, I wrote a show, they added something to it, I wrote on what they added. Mm-hmm. So we built together. It was that kind of a thing. It was something that was easy for me and is easy for them because I was doing what they did best for them.
Now, in the course of this first 6 weeks, At what point was it when someone said, "Don't stop, keep going"?
Oh, after the second episode, we only started off with 2 stations, I think it was San Francisco, and I think Los Angeles. After two episodes, three more stations asked if they could have it. And by the end of the 6 weeks, we had the whole NBC network on the West Coast and Mountain Time. Mm-hmm. And we had a sponsor, Snowdrift and Wesson Oil was our first sponsor, because their product was only in the mountain states and the West Coast at that time. And then after, I've forgotten exact dates, but let's say a year or a year and a half after that, there was a cigarette company came to NBC and said, with a new cigarette. This was, I've even forgotten the name of the cigarette, but anyway, it was supposed to be waterproof so you could smoke it in the rain or in the shower or anything. Well, their first, they bought it for 13 weeks nationally. This was their first touch of nationally. And all our warehouses were cleaned out after the first episode.
Really sold but, cigarettes?
Yeah, but after that, nobody bought any more cigarettes. They were terrible cigarettes. And more than that, the churches began to hit NBC. You can't do this. This is American Family, and you're tying American Family into cigarettes, and they just wouldn't have it. And they wrote to the cigarette company and says, no, we won't. We wouldn't think of buying your cigarettes if you're ruining a family show. And well, the cigarette company, after 9 weeks, said we'd like to get out of this contract because it isn't. People won't accept it. Well, that aroused national commercial interest immediately. Mm-hmm. And Standard Brands snapped us up right on top of, I think, 1 or 2 weeks passed before everything was set up. And they were with us for 15 years. We had the same sponsor for 15 years. We had Tenderleaf Tea. Tenderleaf Tea was a little tea outfit in up in Massachusetts in a place that Standard Brands had bought. Mm-hmm. And we made it a number one tea in the nation inside of a couple of years. And let's see, Tenderleaf Tea, and well, we went through the whole Standard Brand list of things in the 15 years. And that's. No.
Well, it's really interesting that here the public who loved the radio show, they really enjoyed it. They felt it had to be a real family.
Yeah.
Yet they wrote to the sponsor saying, you don't belong as the sponsor of this, as opposed to them saying, well, we're grateful for you to bring this
well,
to us.
Well, but you see, they were just as loyal as when they got Standard Brands. Mm-hmm. Everybody bought everything that the Standard Brands put on the show. So so it was a good, sound, loyal audience.
You were on in the beginning for a half an hour a week.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for 18.
For
well, till I went back to New York to put it on television, which was in around 49 or 50. So it was half hour once a week all that time from, let's say, 32 to 50, 18 years. And then when I went back to New York, to do it on television. We got a radio sponsor 5 times a week, and I had to get some extra help because I was back in New York rewriting the shows for television.
I was going to say, were you doing the television series of One Man's Family? Did that? Did you pick up some of the previously written scripts and then adapt them to TV, or did you write new things for television?
No, I started the story from the beginning. It was a complete. It was all, except for the basic characters and plot. I had to change things. See, this was 18 years later, mm-hmm. and already there were changes of all sorts in public thinking, yeah. family thinking, and so forth, as well as the media. Television hated words. They wanted action. They wanted pictures, mm-hmm. and so forth. So I had... And I'd never done anything like that before, so I had the double chore of learning a new way of entertaining people.
Must have been pretty exciting, though, to get into
Well,
the
it
TV.
Was. It was, and I enjoyed it tremendously. And I sat very close. You couldn't possibly, after we'd selected the cast in New York, because the radio cast was out here doing the 5 a week show,
mm-hmm.
I had to have a director and some production help and things like that. I mean, it began to get a lot of people having a part in the thing, and to me, that this was the wonderful part of radio. I selected a cast, I wrote for it, I directed it. And the final show was my conception of what the show should be.
Mm-hmm.
With television, you had a director in there that says, well, I'm a person too, and I've got some thinking about this thing, and it's almost impossible to get exactly what you want, because somebody else wants something too. Mm-hmm. And this is the way I got out of television, because after the 4 or 5 years, I said, first, I ought to be 20 instead of 49 or 50.
Mm-hmm.
And second, it isn't my work any longer. I was jealous of my work, and I wanted to have it done my way. And that was kind of a little bit dog in the manger, I guess. But nevertheless, if it was my work, I wanted.
Did you write? Getting back to the radio for a while again. Did you write each and every episode?
I did.
Totally.
For the first 18 years.
Everything.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. And then. About the time that I was getting ready to go east, Harlan Ware, who was had written a number of very successful novels and had done some radio work in the east, in Chicago, I believe it was, and then came out to the coast and was doing motion pictures. So I got him started. He would do little excerpts on various characters till he felt that he had what I had been giving the public, and then he would write, maybe a third of an episode, and then finally. So when I went back east, he was thoroughly familiar with the show. And then Mike Raffetto, who had played Paul this was 5 a week, and that meant twice and a half more scripts, mm-hmm. and half hour once a week. So I put Dan Paul and Harlan on the radio show while I was writing the TV show in New York, mm-hmm. and then I'd fly back and forth ever so often to be sure that everything was harmonious, and I was ready to I was ready to give up television by the time those years. Then we brought the television show to the coast, and I had an entirely new set because we were going to do it in a different format. They wanted it five times a week.
The TV thing?
For TV.
Did it play?
In the daytime, huh?
Did it play 5 days a week in
yes,
the daytime then, too?
Yeah, for about 2 years, 2.5 years.
But see, I don't remember the daytime One Man's Family on television.
Yeah.
I remember the Prime show once a week.
Yeah.
But the... You see, their thinking is that it's a soap opera then, wasn't it?
Well,
and it was never a soap opera.
It never did, and it wasn't even in the... Just because a thing is 15 minutes five times a week doesn't mean it's a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
The critics, the people who talked about it in the papers and so forth, without even knowing what they were talking about, we're calling it a soap opera.
Just because it was a more or less serious family show as opposed to situation comedy, they assumed it was a soap opera.
Yeah.
But a soap opera sometimes doesn't have any relationship at all to a real life situation.
That's
yet
right.
One Man's Family was absolutely cut from the cloth of real life.
Well, that's... Thank you. That I'm not the only one to say that, because that's what I felt all along. As a matter of fact, I absolutely horrified by the fact that people couldn't distinguish between a dramatic family show and soap opera.
Well, I think the general public, they may have referred to One Man's Family as a soap opera just out of the lack of any other term. They used a convenient term for it. The critics or the people in the business called it a soap opera because they didn't really pay that much attention, probably.
Right.
You know,
right.
They really weren't right with it, but Lord knows it wasn't that. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask, you were 30 or 31 when you started this,
mm-hmm.
And yet you were able to create an entire family from the father, the mature father of the family, down to the younger children as you went along, the grandchildren and all that. Did you draw on any of your own life experience? You must have drawn your own experiences.
It's basically what I absorbed from family life as a child myself. I felt that Paul, who was the idealistic one, and Father Barber, who was liberal, and Father Barber, who was very conservative, and I always felt they represented two sides of my nature. I am very conservative, and yet I am outraged by so many of the things that the conservative people do.
Mm-hmm.
There was always a conflict in myself. I never was able to have a business. I had no business instinct at all. As a matter of fact, when I was in the University of California, one summer I went out. I wanted to make a little money, so I got tied up with one of these book deals, you know, dictionaries and general information and so forth. The only person I ever sold one of these books was, my territory was to be up in Southern Oregon where I was raised as a boy,
mm-hmm.
and I knew a lot of people in that area, and I knew the country. The only person I ever sold was a man who had once worked for my father on the ranch, and when he lost his job on the ranch, he'd gone as a workman on the railroad, on track, fixing the track and so forth. Well, he booked sold for about $50-$60, and I don't imagine he made more than that a month in those days. And so I sold this to him and got a $5 deposit. And he just worried me to death. And so the next day I went back and I said, "May I see your contract?" And he showed it to me, and I tore it up and handed him his $5 back and said, "You don't want this." And that was my that can tell you my career as a businessman.
That reminds me of one of the members of the family who never could. Who was involved in the...
Oh, that was Pinky, wasn't it? That was the grandson.
Well, Pinky, of course, he left school and he had to go into the... he was all in love with this young lady, and finally he went up to the lumber camp there to work.
That's right.
Those were very, very fine programs, though, and they were so real. And as we listened to them, they just... even today, 20 years after the fact, 25 years later, yeah. Some of those, the philosophy and the feelings, the morality of it all, it still is very valuable. It means a lot today, as it did then. And yet, you were writing on a very contemporary scene.
That's right.
You seldom had a flashback. I don't remember any flashbacks.
The only flashbacks would come when the children was ill or in trouble or something. He used to take them on his knee and tell them stories of his childhood, but no real flashbacks at all.
Father Barber was a... he had retired. Had he been retired from his brokerage firm at the time of the inception of the show?
No. As a matter of fact, it was because Paul, he had hoped that Paul and Clifford would come into the brokerage house, and neither Clifford wasn't capable, and Paul would have nothing to do with it, he thought. No. He thought the... First World War, our entrance into it was not for the best reasons, and he would have nothing to do with the business. So when Father Barber got up into his middle 60s, I guess he sold the business out and retired.
Mm-hmm. How did you manage to find and keep actors in a series for 18 years or longer?
Well,
I mean, it's amazing that J. Anthony Smythe was Father Barber. That was mostly all he did, wasn't it? That he stayed with the show and did not much else.
Yeah. Most of them did the same thing. Well, I paid them about twice as much as the ordinary actor was getting that day, and there was a we were in this together. I mean, I wasn't really, I didn't feel that I was a boss, and I didn't boss anybody, and I listened when anybody had anything to say, and it was what the heck? It was an easy thing. The money was very good for the well, until we got up into the Second World War, then it was nothing tremendous. But and a typical example, when Paige Gilman was drafted and went to Korea, we paid him all the time he was in the Army.
You did? Mm-hmm. Well, there really was one man's family was really your family, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. The family of actors and actresses putting the show together.
That's right.
Now, you had, from time to time, there would be a tragedy in the family. Someone would die or they would leave the family mm-hmm. situation. I'm sure there's no hard and fast rule on this, but mm-hmm. in some cases, it was prompted by an actor's decision to leave the situation. Or,
well, Claudia, for instance, the original Claudia, Kathleen Wilson, married a publisher in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so we replaced her eventually. Mother Barbara was such a dominating part of the show that when she must have been about 80 when she had to retire because she just couldn't get down to the studio sometimes, and I replaced her. Clifford, when he died, we didn't replace him. We sent him out to someplace else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In most cases, I didn't want to replace. Sometimes they're very, for instance, Walter Patterson, who played Nicky, that was Claudia's,
mm-hmm.
or I mean, yeah, Claudia's wife, or husband, he committed suicide. Well, we didn't make anything of it, but it was a Saturday night that he did it, and the show was on Sunday, and he was in heavy in the script. So I had about 3 hours to rewrite, and it wasn't possible to get somebody to do it
mm-hmm.
So fast. So he went, I sent him to the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. And he was
because he was an Englishman, and I sent him back to join his old troops in England, and just wrote him out until, I think it was 3 years later that I brought both Claudia and Nicky back with different people playing.
But there was a sufficient length of time in there that anyone who may, people wouldn't remember the voice,
that's right.
The difference like that.
And we had very good people playing this part, so, and secondly, so it went out fine.
Did you ever create a character within or outside of the family that you decided you didn't like anymore?
I learned this very quickly when I was doing my first mystery stories, adventure stories, up here in San Francisco. I would cast the role, and if one of the players was really bad or didn't sell a part, he would be the first one to go. when he started killing members off, he would be. We got rid of them all too fast.
So that's how it is with the. With the Morrises. That's only half of the story of Carlton E. Morris. We haven't even talked about I Love a Mystery and so many other things. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll get back to thank you very much, Carlton E. Morris. Stick around. Don't touch that dial.
On December 9, 1939, Harold Leopold, 31, switched on his radio in Colorado Canyon City State Prison death row and heard the final chapter of Hollywood Cherry, the current I Love a Mystery serial. 2.5 hours later, according to the Denver Post story, he was led to the gas chamber, saying, "It was great. I got the final solution to the story just in time. I Love a Mystery is my favorite radio program." Leopold died for the murder of a Denver restaurant proprietor.
That's Carlton E. Morris, creator of I Love a Mystery, reading one of the news clippings, one of about a million news clippings, I would say, that you have gathered over the years for I Love a Mystery and One Man's Family. People really turned on to your radio efforts, didn't they?
They really did, and I'm awfully glad that I got in first on these things, because it's terrible competition these days. I'm just as glad to be out of it.
Well, now, you had done so much with the family, One Man's Family, and the real solid kind of a family life show. When did you turn to writing the adventure and the mystery of I Love a Mystery?
Well, in 1939, we had been on,
7 years on the One Man's Family?
Yeah, about 7 years on with the family. And I suddenly began to feel that this was too much. I needed something besides the family, and it wasn't that I wanted to give the family up, but I wanted to be free for a few hours with something else. Advertising agency suggested that they would like to see what I could do in the way of I Love a Mystery, or a mystery. They said, write 2 or 3 shows what you'd like to do, and give us an outline. And so I chose 3 characters, Jack, Doc, and Reggie. I gave several titles. Among them was I Love a Mystery, which the agency selected. And they didn't even read the scripts. They just said, okay, well, we've set up a date with NBC. It'll be 5 times a week. And
you mean just on the basis of the titles that you submitted, and your credentials as a writer?
Well, of course, yeah. I've been writing for them, for Standard Brand, for 5 or 6 years.
Were you employed by NBC or by Standard Brand, by the agency?
I was up to that point. Up to that point, and for quite a long time afterwards, I was on the NBC staff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, through sponsorship, I began to make so much more money than as a staff writer that I was released from the staff and depended on sponsors for money after that.
Well, it's traditional in radio that sponsors have more money than radio stations.
That's right.
Well, I Love a Mystery, then. They bought that, even though they had asked you to make write up a couple of shows, mm-hmm. they bought it and put you on right off the bat.
Well, I think that I Love a Mystery was a wonderful title for a show. It would almost sell a show itself, and it did in this case.
What were the alternate titles? Can you remember the alternate titles you suggested?
I have the biggest idea.
Who cares?
I have the biggest idea then. My original thinking was there would be no drinking, they wouldn't carry guns, they were what I had thought might be that they would solve situations for either individuals or a city, or that they would have no headquarters, that they would go where the trouble was.
Mm-hmm.
And but I kind of got away from that as I got into it. You had to have more of a basis for around which activity.
Mm.
So while they finally settled down to the A1 Detective Agency,
and our heroes were
they did travel a lot. Uh-huh. I mean, what I tried to do was to give a variety of color of places and situations. And that may sound funny on for radio.
Not at all.
But believe me, the listener's imagination is much more wonderful than any picture you can put on television. Mm. That's one of the things I was glad to get out of television, because faces get awful tiresome. And the same background gets awful tiresome. But if you can imagine the thing, a face never gets tired. I mean, we proved that with a family, 27 years. Anybody mm-hmm. could stand any show 27 years. They, that was what was in themselves, not what I gave them the lead, but they developed it in themselves.
Well, you and the listener were participants together in One
right.
Man's Family and in I Love a Mystery as well.
That's right.
Because equal participation
that's
was
right.
very important to it.
That's right. Several times I have, at request, have gone down to local schools down here and played some old I Love a Mystery shows for them,
mm-hmm.
and most of them had didn't know anything about radio, because there was nothing on to attract their attention, really. These mm-hmm. days, radio is pretty hard to,
yeah.
When they've got to go in and turn on the television set and see everything. I would always start out by saying, now you've got two wonderful ears which can hear things, and you've got a wonderful imagination up here. So I suggest, while you're listening to this, close your eyes and just let your ears and your imagination take over, and see if you don't get a very interesting picture. And with a few exceptions, there's always... kids, you know, that do anything except what you tell them.
Yeah.
So, but in most cases, I got an immediate response. People weren't used to radio, got all excited and interested in the thing. And I think that's I think television is the worst thing that's happened to this country as far as children are concerned. This was good. This idea of making yourself work with the show, it gave you a feeling of part of being a part of it. Whereas these pictures in front of a television show,
the kids today can't participate.
No, that's right.
That's why radio could still be very
sure.
Big.
It's simply that the networks don't want. They don't want radio to take away any of the, and they could do it so much cheaper, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just.
But let's get back to the great days of radio and I Love a Mystery. Now, you selected as your three members of the A1 Detective Agency, Jack, Doc, and Reggie, people who had been very familiar to you, because I think each one of them had roles.
That's
at
right.
that time, and I love in One Man's
Family. Yeah, yeah. Mike Raffetto, Barton Yarborough, and Walter Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and perhaps on my part, I was being a little bit lazy. Already going out and getting new characters, but what the heck? If you've got the best voices, and why not use them?
Sure.
And
well, as people you work with too, and they work with you, so
sure.
You can you have an immediate rapport.
Well, not only that, but financially, it was it added to the hold that I had on.
Well, what about now? You ran. You know, we didn't talk about. We were talking about One Man's Family before, and we didn't even talk about the books and chapters that you had set up. Were you writing chapter one, book one, right from the top?
Yeah.
And it was your thought that at the end of a book, that would be more or less the beginning of another story in the life of someone.
Yeah. Well, I tried to. I had a feeling in reading a book. If you'd had a book this long and it wasn't broken up, it was good reading, but it would be awful a long time before you got to the end. But if you had, say, 13 episodes to a book, and the book came to a sort of climax, at least enough of a climax so that you felt that a story had been told, it would be easier to listen to you. It would give you a feeling of well, it's like building a house. There's so many windows here and so many doors there and so forth, and that all makes sense. And when the house is complete. There, 13 windows.
Well, you knew that you were going to achieve an end. That, of course, is one of the things that really set it just physically apart from any of the soap operas, because the soaps never ended. They just went on and on.
That's
yet here you had, the listener was not aware of how many chapters there were going to be in your book, because it varied from book to book, I think.
That's right.
But at least by saying chapter one of book 27... it implied that this story that we're hearing now was going to come to a conclusion.
That's right.
And
also it gave background to things that had gone on, whether you heard it or not, things that had gone on with these people before.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, now you did the same thing then with, incidentally, that was very unique. I don't think anyone ever used that kind of a chapter and book situation in any other radio or television or motion picture or anything like that.
I don't
think
so. Yeah.
But the Isle of a Mystery now, we did the same thing. We had the Temple of the Vampires and the thing that cried in the night. Hollywood Cherry, you mentioned that before when we were reading the clipping about the prisoner who he heard the end of that episode of that story. Now he could go to meet his maker.
That's right.
You had that pretty much the same way too, with maybe only a single chapter or two as a transition.
That's right.
And then they would jump back and refer to something that had happened before. But this was really exciting radio, and that came on late at night, didn't it?
Well, I don't know what it originally. Did you hear the original Hollywood?
I'm mostly familiar with the later version from the.
Well, I don't know what the timing was on that, because I was back and forth in New York and doing television, so I didn't follow that as closely. I mean, I directed a great many of those shows, and
well, the first series, though, from when was it? From 39 through 44.
Yeah.
They were on at one time or other on each of the three major networks too.
Yeah,
it bounced from NBC to CBS, and then I guess it was even Mutual there back in.
Well, that was our second time was Mutual. I did it for Mutual.
What about that? Now here you had a successful series. I Love a Mystery ran for 4 or 5 years, around 39 to 44. And it was off the air for maybe 3 or 4 years, and came back again, basically the same stories.
Yeah, they all were the same stories. Well, it was 10 years.
It was 10 year difference.
I believe
from the beginning of the. I think the second series. My notes say the second series ran from about 49 to 52.
Yeah, well, the first one started in 39.
39, yeah, to 44.
So 10 years.
From the beginning of the first to the beginning of the second.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't think I get your question.
No, I was going to say, why did you do it again? Why did you do it a second time?
Money.
That's a good answer.
Sure.
They came to you and said, we'd like for you to do this again.
Yeah, we'll give you $1,000 a week and pay the cash for a second, for a rerun. And it was very good for them. They made
it was easy for you because you apparently some things had
to
be updated.
What I did was, you see, on NBC for a while we did half-hour shows, quite a few of them, and I broke those all down into 15 minutes, so everything was 15 minutes for them.
For Mutual,
yeah.
In the second round. Tony Randall was in that. And,
that's right.
Russell Thorson, who was part of the One Man's Family scene.
That's
and
right.
Jim Bowles. Was Jim in the One Man's Family cast?
He was in the television.
The TV.
Back in New York. Yeah. He was.
And you used Mercedes McCambridge a lot then.
Oh, very much, yes. Both out here in Hollywood and in New York, yes.
She was always the weeper, the screamer, the,
and,
the
yeah,
terrorized young lady.
Yeah. She was an amazing girl. She was one of the most diversified actresses. She didn't sound always like Mercedes McCambridge, believe me.
You had the Carlton E. Moore style of writing mystery shows is legendary in the history of radio, especially as it relates to your use of descriptive material in the script for the actors.
Yeah.
You used to write all kinds of special information, I guess, for the writer, for the actor to read in order to help him deliver his line.
That's right.
Now, what kind of a setting was it? What did you?
Well, that
you
was it had to. you had to know where the actor was, so that his action fitted into his background, and he had to carry the scenery load. Along with his characterization, and it had to be in the form of his character that he was doing this. For instance, when I think a wonderful scene on the fear that crept like a cat. they were up in they were on a small boat, and it was wrecked up in Puget Sound, and here they were in the Sound, mid-Sound, and trying to keep afloat and so forth, and I let Doc his comedy about swimming around in the nude, and he got on to the story of when he and his little girl cousin, Winnie Mae, used to go swimming in the hog pond in Texas, wear gunny sack bathing suits, a pure comedy, and yet he set all the water that was the scene that was necessary that. It was so well in the public's mind that you could go on and carry on the conversation about getting out and who the hell had run him down and all that sort of thing without having to keep refer to that you were swimming or trying to.
Well, it was amazing. So I think the director and the writer merged together. You had done all the directing, and in your writing, you're giving direction,
that's
telling
right.
how to
that's right.
To see that. I have to look at your scripts to see some more of that.
Sure. And another funny one was the Temple of Vampires. They were the priests in the temple swang across 200 or 300 feet, swung across the from ledge to ledge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Doc was on one side, one ledge on one side of the temple on a rope, and Jack was on another rope on the other ledge. Without knowing that the other was coming, they swang together, and the rope twisted up, and here they were, 50 feet from the ground, 75 feet to where the ropes were tied, and here they were just hanging there, and they had to climb up these ropes. And puffing and so forth, to the point where Barton Yarbrough almost fainted. We had to stop. It was at a rehearsal, and we had to stop and let him get his breath back.
You see, now something like that could never have been done on television.
No.
You know, that's the beauty of the imagination being involved in it. You know, and here the actors obviously got caught up in this thing.
That's right.
I'm sure the actors looked at anything that they did for you as much more than just a job.
I know,
like the family. I mean, these people really, they took on the characters.
Those old days, you had time not only to be thoroughly rehearsed, but you had time to be sociable. So everybody, it was kind of fun to come down to the studio because you're going to, like going to the club and playing golf or someplace else. So these are things that very few people in their business life can do. So the making of good money and happy relationship is out of this world. You can't buy that.
Well, you've made some good friends with the radio audience over the years, too. They really enjoyed your material. Now, you did other things, too, besides One Man's Family and I Love a Mystery. Now, you had a series with Barry Fitzgerald for a while.
His Honor the Barber, yeah. That, unfortunately, only lasted about 9 months because the Irish were, I don't know to this day what he was or where he was in the situation in Ireland, but I do know that the Irish came down in Boston and threw rocks at the radio station.
Really?
And scared the hell out of the sponsor, and so.
Well, Barry Fitzgerald played a barber, and he was a judge or something, wasn't he? A small town barber, and here's the barber coming in there again. It's very interesting.
I don't know.
That's interesting.
I think it was excellent. I hope this is going to be edited.
I'm sorry, don't worry.
No,
it was a good series.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote a series for Mercedes McCambridge, too, didn't you?
Yes, called Family Skeleton. Family Skeleton.
And what was that about? Was that a mystery?
It was it was in a hometown setting up in the northwest, west someplace, it was a kind of a spy story.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big airplane factory near the place, and supposedly the Russians were either trying to get information or. Mm-hmm. Are milk the factory or something like that. And Mercedes was a small-town teacher in the school, and her father had been a district attorney at one time. He was kind of a person of importance. Well, a stranger came into town, and she fell in love with him. And suddenly, he had to get out of town. And you, knowing the background of this thing, that was he a spy or was he something else? But anyway, he took her along, eloped with her, and that was the beginning of her trouble. They went to an airplane finally, and he was taken aboard and went off towards Russia. So you didn't know what he just used her as an instrument for getting out. Or it was a long, involved story. But
well, most of the things that you did were long and involved, but they were done in such a way that the listener could clearly catch on, and even, you know, listening, picking up in One Man's Family, if you hadn't been around for six books, for example, you could pick up, and I mean, you'd have a question sometimes that it would refer to something that happened, but the stories were so interesting and entertaining and exciting, especially in the case of I Love a Mystery, that it was all there in itself. Now, you did I Love Adventure, too, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I was going to, I did also a syndicate series called Mysteries by Morse. And that was a 52 half-hour show. And they all...
was that Captain Friday? Is there a story about Captain Friday?
Yeah.
I've heard something of that. Yeah,
yeah. That was a series. And then the Adventures. I Love Adventure. I did that for, I think I did 13 of them for ABC, using Jack Dawkin. It was after the I Love Mysteries for All.
After the second round of it.
Yeah,
Did you have another version? We're broadcasting for listeners in Chicago. Didn't you have another version of a kind of a family story that was set on the North Shore in Chicago? Up in the Wilmette, Winnetka area? Was it maybe
Was that the Woman in My House?
Woman in My House, right.
Yeah, that was pure tragedy as far as I was concerned. I don't remember. I think this was while I was still doing the television shows, and an agency came to me and said, "Well, couldn't we do One Man's Family from the beginning with different names and a different locale and so forth?" And I said, "Well, I don't see anything. Why not?" But I said, "That's going to mean that I'm going to have to get another writer and director to help me." Between the writer and the director, and I was so busy in New York, they didn't follow the One Man's Family story, although the show went on for 7 years.
The woman went on for 7 years.
Yeah, and paid good money, and I just hated it. I couldn't bear to listen to it.
I have never heard that on one of those shows.
Well, you'd miss nothing.
Well, people who didn't grow up with One Man's Family or with I Love a Mystery or most of the good stuff that Carlton E. Morris created missed something too,
yeah, well, thank
I
you.
Would really say. And we wouldn't have missed this chance to come visit you in your home here, high above California, I guess.
Well, I hope I've given you what you wanted.
You've given us a chance to meet you, which is exactly what we want. And I want to thank you very much for all the good imaginative radio you've provided me and millions of radio listeners. Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Well, thank you very much.